And good morning, everyone. Of course, that very familiar music means that it is the Walt Bodine Show. My name is Russ Simmons, and I'm one of the film critics. And so that means it's Film Critics Day here on the Walt Bodine Show. Our fearless leader is feverishly working on his big New Year's Eve celebration, so he won't be with us today. But we're going to go ahead and carry on in his stead. And I'm joined today by...
Good morning and Happy New Year. It's Marie Asner with the Metro Voice News, phantomtollbooth.org, and onairprep.com.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas and also review films on KXTR.
Welcome all. And of course, this is the end of the year. And at the end of the year, we always like to share with you our best and worst of the year. And so since we've come to the end of 2011, we're going to be sharing those choices with you. But here's what we would like. We'd like to know what your favorite movie of the year was. What did you see in a theater that you would recommend to all the other Walt Bodine listeners? And is there one you'd like to warn them against? Is there a real stinker that you happened to see in 2011? And so when your friends go to the video store or they're considering downloading something or some streaming video, tell them that is a title to avoid. So give us a call at 816-235-2888 and let us know what your favorite and your worst movie of the year were. And you can also contact us at waltbodineshow@kcur.com. But before we get into the list, we're going to go ahead and talk about some of the movies that have opened since we were last on the show. And so we're going to start out with the top movie at the box office right now, and that is Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol.
Well, it may be a surprise to a lot of people, perhaps a bit to me as well. It's well done. There's lots of thrills, chills, and spills. Tom Cruise, I think, invests some real personality into the role. And there are moments of comedy, satire, that were more than welcome. I'm going to confine my remarks to just one example of this, which is when the message is delivered and we know that the tape will deconstruct itself within 5 seconds. Okay, so there's Tom Cruise. He's at what looks like a post box or phone booth. Okay, and the message is going to destroy itself in 5 seconds. So Cruise walks towards the camera and counts down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, nothing. He then turns around, walks back to the phone booth, and whomps at one, at which point the message destroys itself. Now, I thought that was kind of funny. Fine.
I did too.
But some Russian friends of mine who grew up most of their lives in Soviet Russia said that that's actually funny for other reasons, which is that nothing ever worked in Russia. And it was frequently the case where you would have to whomp at one to make it work. So they thought it was hilarious for a completely different reason. I love that. I'm going to give the thing 3.5 stars.
Marie?
Well, I would love to see the schematics of the stunts that Tom Cruise did. I mean, this is the most choreographed movie you've ever seen. It's like take 2 steps, hit somebody on the right, do a somersault, sock somebody in the left, and so on. And it just works together beautifully. It's like watching a ballet. And also, before the program started, we were talking about the climbing of the large, is it tower or hotel in Dubai? And Tom Cruise was supposed to have done this without the aid of anything. It's these special gloves that have magnetic things on them that he can climb up. Well, you know, in one of the shots, you can see the light reflecting off the guide wire. So they forgot to take that one out. So, I mean, they're not going to let their top star fall down, you know, a couple thousand feet. But that's a scary sequence where he has to go from one floor to the other. It's a good addition to the set of the Mission Impossible. Films. You've got the standard soundtrack in the background. You recognize the melody. The action gal this time is a nice surprise. It's Paula Patton from Jumping the Broom. And she said she'd been in training for months to do her stunts, and boy, does she do it. She's very good in this, a very good action one. And we've got Jeremy Renner in here. And the only exception that I would say is to casting is that they advertise and give top billing to Ving Rhames. 30 seconds is what I counted of him, and I waited and waited and waited till he finally showed up because he's one of my favorites. Fans would not be disappointed, fans of Tom Cruise or of this series, and I would give it a 3.
You know, this is the first live-action film directed by Brad Bird, who's an animator. And so I was interested in seeing what he would be able to do when he had to worry about where to place the camera. When you're working in animation, you know, you can put the perspective anywhere you want it. But he had to be confined by actual camera placement, but I thought he did a great job. This is the guy who did The Incredibles, and so you know that he brought that same kind of sensibility, that action sensibility that works so well in The Incredibles, to Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and I thought it worked beautifully.
Does anybody remember the credit sequence? What a dynamite, literally, credit sequence that is, where a fuse is lit after an opening jailbreak sequence. And as the fuse lights, we follow the burning fuse about 6 miles cross town and against the credits. It was just wonderful, and it jet propels you into the rest of the film.
I saw it on the IMAX screen, which I think probably added a lot as well. So it does. There is that option out there in many theaters to see the IMAX version. If you really want to see this movie and you're willing to pay the extra couple of bucks or whatever for the IMAX, then I think it's probably worth it in this case. I'm going to give it a 4. So between a 3.5, a 3, and a 4, we're going to average it out to a 3.5 for Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. It's rated PG-13. And we want to encourage you to let us know what your favorite movie of the year was and what your worst was. And we got a call from Eric from Overland Park. Hi, Eric. Welcome aboard.
Hello.
So you've got some choices for us.
Yes. Well, my favorite movie of the year was Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I just thought that was great. I'm a big fan of the old, whatever five movies is. I don't know what word that is. And I just thought the newest one, they did a really good job of rebooting it while still maintaining the flavor and kind of the feel of the old ones, but using the technology of the day to make it awesome.
Yeah. And it's on my top five, yeah.
How about a worst pick?
Well, I was talking with the woman who answered the phone. I don't know if this one counts because it came out last year, but I didn't see The Kids Are All Right until this summer.
I see.
And I did not understand why that was ever made into a movie at all.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a film that got a lot of praise. As a matter of fact, got some Oscar nominations right. as well.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
thanks.
It was just confusing to me.
I understand. Thanks, Eric. Appreciate your call.
Thanks.
And we had a caller also who, a writer at KCUR.org, I believe it was Don, who said, I was very happy with Paul featuring Simon Pegg. I absolutely thought it was going to bomb, but I found myself laughing out loud. That's a story about a kind of a comic take on E.T. And according to IMDb, Paul is a movie about two British comic book geeks traveling across the U.S. and they encounter an alien outside of Area 51. So that's a pick from Don. You guys remember that
yes,
one as well?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Let's move on to another film that we've all three seen. It actually opened on December 20th, and it's the English language adaptation of the Swedish thriller The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Marie?
Okay, this comes under the category of why so soon after the first one do we have to remake the film? You can ask Hollywood that. You know, they've probably got an answer for it. So we have the American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Rooney Mara, a little-known actress until now, does her very best to do the title role, but she pales in comparison to Noomi Rapace, who is also in the Sherlock Holmes film that we'll be discussing later. She looks like a little sparrow. There's nothing frightening about her. But I like the way Daniel Craig portrayed the journalist. There's one scene in there where he's searching for a clue, and he's got everything stretched in front of him. He's got sharpened pencils, a pencil sharpener, the map on the wall, and all this. And all of a sudden, bingo, he catches something in his eye, and away he goes on the chase. I thought he handled that very well. I thought this was really Daniel Craig's film. Other than that, there are some things that were in the first film that are not here. There are some things that were in the book that are not here. I wish in all the cases they would do something with her choosing her apartment. I thought it was described so well in the books how she did that, and there's nothing here. She simply walks into the room, you know, and that's hers. I think they lost something there. It's action filled. It's not for everyone. It definitely has an R rating. I'm going to give it 3.5.
Well, David Fincher certainly is proving himself to be a master of the procedural investigation. And that's exactly what Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is. Essentially, you've got a couple of plot lines, certainly, that emerge predominantly. And to track those down, follow them through with all the various technologies at their disposal, makes for fascinating watching. But it's in the characters, guys. I came out of the film going, why? Why Bother? Noomi Rapace was fantastic in the role, and she's not bettered here. All respects to Rooney Mara. I forget the name of the guy who played Blomqvist, but he was wonderful, too. All respects to Daniel Craig.
Michael Nyquist, I think his name is.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe it's not as glossy or as smooth as the Fincher version, but go see the Swedish version. That's the one that delivers. Mm-hmm. This one is fine. I'm going to give it 2.5 stars, but I would have given 4, and did give 4, I think, at the time, to the original mm-hmm. Swedish language yeah. version, which played in a lot of theaters, including mm-hmm. here in Kansas City.
I like both versions. I thought they were both quite good, and I think that David Fincher brings some interesting elements to me that I felt were missing in the first film. Hmm. However, I thought Noomi Rapace was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And although Rooney Mara, I think, is very good, I don't think she quite had that same, kinky, kind of strange yeah. and otherworldly kind of aspect to her character that Noomi Rapace brought to the character of Lisbeth Salander. This movie is very sleazy, if you know.
Yeah, that's a good term.
I think that it's, lurid at the least, but just be forewarned, it earns its R rating. But I think it's very smart, extremely well made, and so I'm going to go with a 4. So with a 2.5 and a
3
and a 4, so shall we say 3? Okay, we'll go with a 3 for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, rated R. I wanted to encourage you to give us a call at 816-235-2888 and let us know what your favorite movie of the year was, and also if there was a real stinker that you want to warn people against that you saw in 2011, let us know what that is. You can also write us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And let's go ahead and talk about another film that actually opened on December 20th. Marie, it's a Cameron Crowe film called We Bought a Zoo.
Matt Damon tries comedy, and he does it in kind of a laid-back style. But, this is a darker film than the way it's advertised. Oh, We Bought a Zoo. I can just see families saying, oh, we've got to take the kids to this movie and everything. It's about a man whose wife passed away 6 months before, and he's trying to raise 2 children, ages about 5 and 13. The oldest one is a boy who's rebelling because nobody talks to him, and he really wants to talk about the death of his mother, and it's not happening. So Matt Damon's idea is, let's get the kids out of the city into the country, and they buy a zoo. Okay, so of course with the zoo comes the people who work there, and then we have Scarlett Johansson as the girl who takes one look at Matt Damon and thinks, wow, this guy's for me. But, he's lost in the shadows, and that's the rest of the film. He is still in depression. There's nothing really bouncy about this except when the film goes to the animals. The kids have cute things to say. The boy finds a girlfriend, and yet Matt Damon is kind of there in the background. It's a darker film. It does address the idea of the ideas of having exotic animals as pets and how much work there is, surgeries that have to be done to keep the animals healthy. So if you ever go and you're driving around the United States and you see roadside zoo, double check to make sure that it's a qualified roadside zoo, because we know that the other ones are out there. I'm only going to give this a 2.5, and I was a bit disappointed. As I said, it's really not for children. I think kids over the age of 10 probably would benefit better from this film.
Yeah, I thought it was very sweet. And I enjoyed it while I was watching it, but it's kind of tending to evaporate from my mind. It's one of those movies that it has some cute dialogue. Cameron Crowe is a good director and a competent writer, and some of his screenplays have just crackled with great dialogue. This one was good, and it's good for the family. It's kind of a sweet-natured movie, but at the same time, it's fairly forgettable. So I'm going to give it a 3. And so we average it out to a 3, Marie. Would you be good with that since you gave it 2.5?
Yeah, that's fine.
We'll give a PG-rated We Bought a Zoo a 3 overall rating. We had Elaine call in who wants to share her favorite movie of the year. Elaine calling from Kansas City. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Well, I want to say that Hugo was just one of the most delightful films I've ever seen. And as a movie lover, it's a movie that everybody has to see who loves movies.
Do you think that people that aren't movie buffs would enjoy this film as well?
Oh, yeah, I do. I think that there's enough of a good story there, although I think it's for older audiences rather than for kids, which I kind of thought initially it was sold for, but I went because it was a Scorsese film, and I never miss a Scorsese film. And he's one of the few film makers who actually understands that 3D should be part of the film and not some special effect. I loved it that there were two scenes that looked like cutouts, cardboard cutouts, and they should have looked like cardboard cutouts, and the rest of it was totally natural.
Thank you so much, Elaine. Appreciate your call.
I also want to say about Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the American version.
Mm-hmm.
Rent the Swedish version. It's far superior.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Elaine. Once again, you're listening to The Walt Bodine Show, and if you'd like to share your picks, 816-235-2888, or write us at The Walt Bodine Show at kcur.org. And on Facebook, David writes, best movie I saw this year was The Skin I Live In. Of course, that was the Pedro Almodovar kind of take on Frankenstein, mm-hmm. and it's a totally demented story, but really engaging, great acting, great filmmaking, interested to know what others thought about it. And that's David writing in on Facebook, so thank you so much, David.
Yeah, we talked about it a lot, and of course it shares with Eyes Without a Face, the great French classic by Franju, this whole idea about skin grafting, body makeovers, all of that, and we see the ultimate example of that in this film. Very creepy. I thought Banderas was really fine in this. He's revealing a kind of darker, more mature quality, I think, in his on-screen work that I'm anxious to see more of. So I recall us all being unanimous about that, I think.
Yeah, we all liked it. Although I have some reservations. I didn't like it as well as you did, John, but I thought it was, obviously, it's very well made.
Well made, but just downright creepy.
It is creepy. It's but then it's a horror film, so there you are. Let's go ahead and talk about one that I'm kind of chomping at the bit to talk about. It's opened on December 20th, and it will continue to slowly open over the next few weeks. It's a movie that's a real Valentine to the movies. It's called The Artist, rated PG-13. And I have to say that this is my favorite film of the year. And I don't necessarily think you have to be a film buff to love this movie. I do think it helps in the case of Hugo. However, yes, if you're a movie buff, you will love The Artist. And I think you may love it even if you aren't a movie buff. Because this is just a brilliantly conceived and executed film that transcends its gimmick. It's a silent film, shot in glorious black and white. And when I say silent, I don't mean there's no sound, because there is a wonderful soundtrack that accompanies this. And there are occasional moments of sound as well that are used very, very cleverly. And it's a story about a man who is a silent film star and has difficulty making that transition to talkies. He just doesn't have maybe what it takes to be a talking film star. And he's usurped by a woman who has come to become very fond of, and she has what it takes to be a star in the talkies. And it's sort of some of the similar themes from A Star is Born, some similar themes from Singing in the Rain, that sort of thing. But I think this movie is really the best movie of the year because it, as I said before, it's more than just a Valentine to the movies. As I was sitting watching, I was thinking one great moment after another that I'm going to remember maybe the rest of my life. And I think this is a movie that I would recommend anybody see. So I'm giving it a 5.
Well, among the cinematic allusions, too, of course, is Greta Garbo and Queen Christina.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have here in the film this woman, Pepi Miller, who has risen to the heights of screen stardom, who is insisting that her co-star in her next talkie be our young man, Charles Valentin, who has now hit the skids. And her insistence that he come out of retirement to work with her is very much like what happened with Garbo with John Gilbert. And indeed, this character is a cross between John Gilbert and Douglas Fairbanks. There's even a brief scene where, very cleverly, shots from a chase scene in Marco Zorro are inserted with close-up shots of the actor playing Charles. And it's pretty seamless. If you don't know quite what you're looking at, you might say, well, wait a minute, I thought that was a Douglas Fairbanks film. However, the formulaic aspect of the plot, that was a downer to me. We have seen this 8,000 times in movies about Hollywood, where the young ingenue gains ascendancy, her mentor retires into obscurity, and what's going to happen after that? And I found that a little fatiguing. I'm not quite sure why it's a silent film. It's clever. I love silent movies, of course. But I think best of all for this are the two featured players. Jean Dujardin, as Charles Valentin and Berenice Bojo as Pepe Miller. These two actors I'm completely unfamiliar with, but they knocked me out. There's vitality. They're having fun. They can dance up a storm. Beautiful characterizations on screen, and that to me is the best part of The Artist. I'm going to give it 3.
Marie?
Oh, this is a wonderful film. It's a black and white film, and it's a silent film about making silent films. So how good can you get? And there is an actor in the film that isn't mentioned, and that is the soundtrack. It picks up exactly where the body language is on the actors. Now, we talk about body language before. When you're speaking, you don't necessarily watch the body language, but here you have to because there are subtitles, and you kind of have to wait till the subtitle is to come along and pick up where everything's going. But it's just so well done, and we forgot to mention the dog. You know, Asta from the Thin Man series, or Rin Tin Tin, or Lassie, you know, the dogs of this particular era. Well, here we've got this little Jack Russell Terrier who is smarter than everybody in the whole movie, who seems to know what's going on. He could probably direct, if he didn't already direct the movie. I found out his name is Oogie, U-G-G-I-E, and really the star of the movie. And all of these things go together to make a film. I couldn't figure out where the artist came in, whether they were referring to the guy who actually really, the real-life director who put this
I'd like
in.
To talk because, about that, actually.
Because nobody there actually was an artist as such. But I'm giving it 4.5, and I never give anything beyond a 4, so this is really something for a 4.5.
Time for a quick note. Mm-hmm. The artist, it seems to be that he has a sense of integrity about his filmmaking that precludes the use of sound. In fact, he has a nightmare sequence where he is unable to speak, even though he's surrounded by a whirl of sounds. Well done. So is the artistry the fact that he insists on a kind of film that no longer is being made? Mm. Or do we see in that the decline of him as an artist because he cannot accept the changes in technology? So I was a little confused about that, as I was
made
about
you think
the
about
ending,
it, though.
We can't talk about it.
So let's go ahead and average The Artist out to a 4. It's rated PG-13. And I want to encourage you, we're talking about the best and worst of the year, and we had a call from Steve, and we'd like to get him in before the break, from North Kansas City. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
Good.
Good, thanks. Real quickly, I also saw the Tom Cruise movie, and it was pretty good. I really liked the building sequence, and the opening sequence, too, I think that John alluded to, was really good. Another movie that came out this year that had a great opening sequence was a Matt Damon movie that had a computer-generated tsunami in it, and I thought that was absolutely wonderful as far as that goes. But my best ones, I would say, in my opinion, was just I thought Super 8 was a highly underrated movie that was good, and I took my daughter to it, and she loved it. Margin Call I thought was good, and another one about clandestine operations that I thought was much better than Mission Impossible was a movie called Hannah.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and the girl in there, she's got a bright future.
Yes.
She's going to be a heck of an actress.
Thank you for your thoughts, Steve. Appreciate your
Thank
call.
You. Appreciate it.
Gabney in Kansas City writes in, the best movie was The Help. Great performances, great adaptation from the book, and the worst, Bridesmaids, a total letdown, not funny, great cast, you had nothing to work with script-wise. If you don't like raunchy humor, then definitely Bridesmaids is not for you. We're talking about the best and the worst of 2011 here on the Walt Boudin Show. So if you have something you'd like to share with us, 816-235-2888, and you can write us at Walt Boudin Show at kcur.org. And we'll be sharing our lists, the best and worst, after the break, but we're going to be taking some time now for some announcements, so stick around. We'll be right back with you. And welcome back. You are listening to The Walt Boudin Show here on KCUR. It is the Movie Critics Day, and we are talking about the best and the worst of 2011, as well as some of the films that have come out over the last few weeks. We're encouraging you to give us a call and let us know what your picks are, 816-235-2888, or write us at waltboudinshow@kcur.org. And then we've got a call from Tony, who wants to talk to us. Tony, welcome aboard.
Hi. I took my grandchildren to see Arthur Christmas, and I laughed so hard. I'm sure I embarrassed them, and I had tears running down my face. It was so good, and it had a good message about Christmas, too. And the movie I disliked the most, I don't even remember the title completely, but it was Prey and Love. Julia Roberts was in it. And me and my girlfriends, and we're senior citizens, we got up and walked out. It was so bad.
Eat, Pray, Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
Last year, I thought.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your call, Tony.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
And we also got someone who wrote in. It's Andy from Olathe, who says, I have to second the recommendation for Hugo. It was one of my daughter's favorite books, so we had to see the movie. I've never seen a movie that stayed so true to the book. You don't have to read the book to get the movie, but I highly recommend reading it because seeing the movie is like seeing the story come to life. We also had a call from John who asked, when will Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy be opening? So I just checked my book, and it is Friday the 6th of January, so you don't have to wait too much longer. Trudy in Roland Park wrote with her favorite, which is Encendies. And that was made my top 10 list as well, Trudy. And her least favorite, Tree of Life, the Terrence Malick movie. I know Marie is happy to hear that because she didn't like that film as well. Let's take a call from Barbara, who is calling from North Kansas City. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Good, love the show. I wanted to make a comment on War Horse. I just saw it a couple days ago, and actually I was kind of disappointed. I didn't think there was very strong character development. I had just read the book prior to seeing the movie. It was a children's book, and the book is told through the eyes of the horse, Joey. And actually, with not having that in the film, I think there was it kind of lost out. The cinematography, of course, was wonderful, and the direction's great, but I just didn't think there was that much of a story, and I was just disappointed. I thought it was a little slow.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate your call.
Bye-bye.
And speaking of War Horse,
might as well go
right at it. Here is one that we were going to be talking about. John, tell us about War Horse.
Well, it is beautifully done. There are a couple of sequences in it that may be a bit strong in terms of it being a family film. I don't think that should detract from its rating in that sense, however. How do you tell a movie through the eyes of a horse? That would be a challenge, all right. It's okay. I liked it a lot. At times, the first third of it reminded me a little bit too much of National Velvet. But I'll tell you, the battle scenes midway through, there's this charge where a group of British cavalry charges upon a Russian contingent. And I mean to tell you, mostly shot from an overhead camera. Unbelievable. And the scene that I might warn parents about, just a touch with kids, is when the horse itself, our horse, runs amok in the trenches and runs through shot and shell, leaps over an armored tank, and then plows through a series of barbed wire fencings until it's hopelessly tangled up in the barbed wire. I mean, it was nightmarish, and it was difficult to watch, and it reminds you that when Spielberg wants to, he can really pull out all the stops. But because it's so beautiful and because I just did not agree at all with the logic of the ending, I think I'm going to give it just a 3.
Marie?
In answer to the lady who called in about actors, were there actors in this movie? I mean, when you've got a horse this beautiful, and that's got to be the most beautiful horse since the movie Secretariat or even the Seabiscuit way back there. I mean, who needs actors? They did their best, you know, like Emily Watson and so on. Beautifully photographed, great soundtrack and everything. But, you know, this is really, to me, an anti-war film told through the eyes or the persona of the horse. And this is a World War I. It's supposed to be the war to end all wars, and yet they've got these magnificent guns. But how do you move them from one location to the other? That hasn't been thought out. That's really not been invented yet. So here come the horses, dragging them up the hills, through the mud, and so on. So that's a war that was not thought out as a war. Of course, they had it solved by World War II, but that's World War I.
Well, they do have mechanized vehicles, but it's when the engines break down
they
need the horses.
Yeah, but see, they've got a hill and how to get up the hill with the gun. You know, they didn't figure that one out very well.
But they can do it as long as the motorized vehicle's motor does not break down.
I know, but that's where the horse comes in.
Exactly.
Yes, right. Okay, we got that solved. Let's see, where else was I? John, you disrupted my train of thought. Oh, yes. This is the most predictable movie also because it's cue the horse and the horse poses. Cue the sunset and there's the sunset. Cue the emotional moment and here comes the music. I mean, it's almost like we've got a clipboard in front of us with it. But all that aside, and I had not read the book, War Horse does come off good. As John said, it's intense for kids probably under the age of 10. This may not be a movie where the kid, your child's going to come home and say, I want a horse. They're going to see all the care that goes into it. So I'm going to give it a 3 for effort. And there always has to be a race in here. And I'm not referring to the race that John was talking about where there's a battle scene. It's about two cavalry officers racing their horses. And that was very well done, too.
You know, I think that the only drawback to this film was the kind of overworking manipulation of the sentimentality. Of course, this is Steven Spielberg, so you can also count on it to be just brilliantly filmed, and it is. The sequence you were talking about, the action sequence, John, about the charge of the cavalry, great. Yeah. But there's also a tremendous scene where the horse gets in the barbed wire.
That's the one.
Oh,
yeah.
That's the one you meant. Okay.
It's so painful to watch.
I don't know how they did it. I swear you, I don't know how he pulled it off. But yeah. It is a brilliantly filmed sequence. Yeah. And that will work at your emotions a little bit right there.
That was one where children, I don't know, how
right.
they'd react.
Be aware, yes.
Yeah. Still, at the same time, you know, I was captivated by it. I thought, you know, I enjoyed just looking at the pictures on the screen because there were some beautiful, beautiful imagery in this film. Didn't quite connect on the emotional level I had hoped to, but on the other hand, admired it tremendously. So I'm going to give it a 3.5. So I think that between the three of us, a 3.5 mm-hmm. is probably apropos for The Horse, and it's rated PG-13, perfectly fine for the whole family. We had Clayton from Ottawa, Kansas write in at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And he shared this. I watched Kwanaskatsi, Life Out of Balance, last night on DVD. I learned of this film through an NPR interview of a director's must-see list. This was a refreshing film for me, even though there was no dialogue. The cinematography and Philip Glass's musical score kept me interested through all 87 minutes. The movie is good for people who are open to new movie experiences and can be moved by artistic ideas in cinematography and in music. And course, it's a classic. Yeah.
Hearing that makes me feel so old because that movie is still so fresh in my memory. I don't regard it as a classic or an old film at all. Absolutely, it's a must see. It's been a must see for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And Marie, what are your memories of that one?
I didn't see that.
She was in swaddling clothes.
Yeah.
At the time.
Yes,
right.
Thank you. I was too young.
So, but we'll let Marie catch up with that one. But yes, it is a classic. And thank you so much, Clayton, for sharing that. You can share your views at 816-235-2888. And you can write us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And Andrea Salenzi, our intrepid producer, has reminded me that Kwanaskatsi is from 1982. So it's been a while ago, but it's not from most of our infancy.
I thought for a while we were talking about one of those clubs, those men's clubs that help out the community, the Kiwanis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No? That's a different movie.
I guess that's right, yeah. Let's take a step back and talk about a movie that opened on December 6th. John, would you lead the way on Young Adult, rated R?
Loved it. Loved it. Bit of a surprise to me. It should not be. Charlize Theron can act, by golly. And this was scripted by Diablo Cody, and Jason Reitman directed it. They also worked together on Juno. So why would I have been surprised? What is interesting about it in the main, I think, is that Charlize Theron plays a woman who is thoroughly despicable. You really don't like this person at all. But guess what? She doesn't like herself either. She has determined, after getting news about a long-lost boyfriend having had a new baby, that she's going to leave the big town of Minneapolis and go to the little town of Mercury, Minnesota, and get this guy back. No matter that he's married, happily, that he has children, and they're wonderful, that his wife is wonderful, no matter, she has a right to get him back. She's the prom queen, he's the stud football player, so they ought to be together. And that is the dynamic going throughout this film. Fantastic ensemble work. Patton Oswalt, a young character actor I was relatively unfamiliar with, plays a buddy, of Charlize Theron's that she hooks up with back in the little town. And their scenes together are delicious because he's world weary. He sees through her pretensions, even if she doesn't. And Patrick Wilson has a very tough role. He's supposed to be the former boyhood hero, and yet he's a bit scuzzied around the edges now. And so he carries off that balancing act very well. Now, I suppose it's all too predictable what happens. But until it does happen, I watched mesmerized at the quality of the acting of this ensemble and the sharp dialogue. It's already in my top five, so I'm going to give it a 4.
I didn't like it quite as well as you, but I think you pointed out the reason why. The character was so dislikable that it was a film I could admire and not enjoy, because I felt totally annoyed the whole time I was sitting through it.
It's a brave piece of acting, I think.
It is, and it's, you know, a lot of people have criticized the screenplay because of the dialogue that seems too calculated or that people don't really talk that way. Well, you know, that's probably a valid criticism, but on the other hand, it's very sharp, smart, interesting dialogue. And yes, it may not be completely believable, as in the case of Juno. Juno, who, you know, Diablo Cody's Oscar-winning screenplay, the girl said things that probably no one would really ever say, but was sure was smart.
But I think viewers, some certainly, will bring a kind of empathy and compassion to watching her in this role, because she left behind the more idyllic small-town life, and she substituted it for work in the big town writing novels for young adults, and she's not happy with it, and the series is declining anyway. So she has a nostalgia, a very strong nostalgia, for what might have been back in that little town. She hates herself for it, but yet she still feels the pull. Hey, I think that is what a lot of us feel as we grow older.
No question about it. I just can't quite go there with you because I found it so annoying. I'm going to give it a 3. You gave it a 4. So we'll average it out, young adult, to a 3.5. And it is rated R because it's got some pretty profane dialogue. So just a bit of a warning there. You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show, in case you are. We're talking about the best and worst of 2011. So give us a call at 816-235-2888 to share your views. Or you can also write us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And that's what Kristen did. Actually, she called in with her favorite, Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Oh, yes.
The 3D documentary. Yeah, very interesting movie. And the worst film of the year, she says, is Shipwrecked. Now, I wonder if she meant Shipwrecked, the Alvin and the Chipmunks movie, perhaps?
Shipwrecked.
That could be, yeah.
Okay. And I can understand that because I've not seen that one, but I've seen the other two previous films. So I would suspect that it's probably a good bet that Shipwrecked is not a great movie classic. So thank you so much, Kristen, for that. And we're you can give us a call as well. Let's move on and talk about a movie that opened on December 20th. It's Steven Spielberg doing double duty this Christmas season with The Adventures of Tintin, rated PG.
Marie, I'd like to have you give us the plot of that film, would you please?
Tintin? I wasn't familiar with Tintin.
I thought I was giving you a joke.
It's a hard
one. Have another cough drop.
Let's hear about that plot, Marie.
It's a hard one to sum up.
That's the point, Marie.
Oh, it's an action film. It's stop action, and that's what I liked about it. But I was not familiar with the character of Tintin. Apparently, in Belgium, this character in comic books is quite popular, and so Steven Spielberg decided to make it into a movie, and it really is almost realistic. The only problem I have is with the dialogues. Jamie Bell is the voice of Tintin, and I can understand him fairly well. But I think it's, let's see, who's got the voice of
Andy Serkis?
Andy Serkis does the voice of the captain, and this is deep brogue, and the captain has a problem with alcoholism, was something else that I didn't care about this film.
He's I had a problem understanding him.
Yeah, understanding him, but he's always got a bottle in his hands, and for a children's film to see this guy laid out flat with a bottle in his hands, I didn't think was very good, because it's like 90% of the movie has him that way. The dog is another dog that steals the show. It's Snowy this time, and so we have Snowy, we have Oogie from The Artist, and the war horse. You know, this
Jody,
is the,
or what is it? What was the horse's name?
Joey.
Joey, yeah.
Joey, yes. This is the year of the animals. They're out to find treasure, and we have good, you know, sea action films. There's a great one, a motorcycle chase with a sidecar. And this is another Spielberg thing that I really like, because there's so many things going on. The sidecar breaks off the motorcycle, and it is with the dog on one side of the screen. The motorcycle's in the middle, and there's another fight going on the other side, so your eyes are going back and forth and back and forth. I saw it in 3D, and I thought that was an enhancement to this movie. I'm going to give it 3.5. And, John, you can figure out the plot.
Yeah, I was kidding about the plot, of course. It's impossible to follow. You've got three different sources of the Tintin books, and they all kind of intermingle, and I got completely lost. The action is unbelievably beautifully staged. This is a benchmark production in terms of the motion capture and CGI. Benchmark all the way. But do you care? Do you really care about anything? Tintin in the original strips is a kind of transparent character anyway, but on screen this can be a disaster. At the heart of the picture is Snowy, mm-hmm. not Tintin. Snowy walks off with the picture. Tintin, he's as transparent as he was on the page.
And rating?
Oh, a grudging 3.
A grudging 3. I'm going to give it a grudging 3.5 because of the visuals. I agree with you that the story is convoluted and the mystery was uninteresting. This is kind of Steven Spielberg's animated take on Indiana Jones. You know, mm-hmm, this is an
right.
Indiana Jones movie animated. So he was able to free himself from the camera placement and do all kinds of exciting visual things. And for that alone, I thought it was worth seeing. So we'll go ahead and give War Horse rated PG, or excuse me, Tintin rated PG a 3 and, oh, excuse me, yeah, PG. I was just double checking that. 3.5 for The Adventures of Tintin. We had Bruce, who wrote to share his best and worst. The best he thought was Beginners. Christopher Plummer getting a lot of notice, probably an Oscar nomination for that one. And Win-Win, which I'm really happy to say is on my top 5 list as well. Such great acting and screenwriting. His worst was Hugo, interestingly enough.
Really?
And War Horse. He didn't like either of those. And he also just adds a comment that documentaries should seek to inform and features to entertain. Mm. And we also have a call from Jacob calling in from Overland Park. Hi, Jacob.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
My favorite movie of the year would be Mission Impossible, the new Mission Impossible. I thought they did a really good job, taking that and just making it an incredible action film. And my least favorite, I'd have to say, is Tree of Life, believe it or not.
There's a very divisive movie. There are some people that think it's a masterpiece and other people that think it's a waste of time, and I suspect that the truth may be somewhere in between. But
I was expecting it to be more of a narrative, but it was more of just beautiful pictures that didn't mm-hmm. really make sense together. So,
thank you so much, Jake. Appreciate your call.
Nope.
Let's go ahead and jump in and give our best and worst lists, and we'll start out with ladies first with Marie. So what were your top 5 movies of 2011?
Okay, let's see. I've got my list right here. I thought I did.
Well, while she's looking,
John, why don't you?
I did want to talk about Young Goethe.
Oh, I just found
get to those.
But I just found it. My top one is a film called Albert Nobbs with Glenn Close, which has not opened here yet. It'll open here the middle of January. Glenn Close plays a woman in 1890s Ireland who has to make herself over as a butler in order to find a job, and she has to carry this persona of being a man over for many years. A beautiful performance. My second one is Margin Call. I thought that was very good with Kevin Spacey's speech to everyone. Page One, the documentary about the background of the New York Times. Number 4, The Ides of March, the George Clooney and Ryan Gosling film. And number 5, I had as The Artist.
Okay, and John?
Well, I have Beginners, which I think a lot of people already have joined me in loving. What a wonderful character study that was, crossing generations. Anonymous. Nobody's talking about Anonymous, but I thought it was a fantastic recreation of Elizabethan England with some very thought-provoking aspects of the identity of the Shakespearean dramas. Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Surprise, surprise, surprise. A superior film in many respects. Young Adult, which we just talked about, and Hugo, which I thought was the best of the year.
All right, and here's my list. The countdown backwards. Number 5, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the English language version, I thought was very good. Also, Win-Win, which one of our callers just mentioned. It's a wonderful little movie about a wrestling coach, part-time wrestling coach in small-town America. Paul Giamatti is priceless, and the dialogue by Tom McCarthy I thought was terrific. Very underrated movie. It had it opened late in the season, I think we'd be talking about a lot more awards consideration for win-win. Number three, Super 8. Super 8 is one of those that got, one of our callers mentioned. I think it's a very underrated film. It's kind of Spielbergian, even though it was directed and written by J.J. Abrams. And kind of a coming-of-age film that just happens to unfold during a bizarre science fiction event. Has a weak ending, but other than that, I thought it was a very good film. Number two, The Help. Making a lot of top lists, the adaptation of the popular novel, and my favorite film of the year, number one, The Artist, one we just covered as well. Okay, let's do the evisceration now. Let's give our worst films of the year, Marie.
Okay, I'm going to start out with Rango, an animated film with the voice of Johnny Depp and scary enough that it could have been a horror film, and I was objecting to it being targeted to children. Number two is Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, a film in search of a lead actress. Number three, Pirates of the Caribbean 4 on Strange Tides. This franchise is destined to go on forever until Captain Jack Sparrow really is at the bottom of the sea forever. Number four, The Tree of Life. The visuals are from Galaxy Productions somewhere. Jessica Chastain looks perpetually perplexed. Sean Quinn is quizzical. And Brad Pitt seems ready to go on to Moneyball. And number five, The Guard. This is a one-man show and should have been billed as such. Brendan Gleeson can't always be understood. And Kansas City's Don Cheadle got top billing. But where was he, poor guy?
All right. And John?
Well, I like The Guard all right because of Don Cheadle and Brendan Gleeson.
You found him in there?
Well, he's in about 50% of the film, but it's not too bad. I really didn't have any worse because I think one reason is that I managed to avoid seeing the films that typically were going to be worse, such as Jack and Jill, which has got to top any list. I defer to Russ.
Okay. Well, here's my list. At number five, I have Bad Teacher, the so-called comedy with Cameron Diaz. At number four, Transformers, Dark of the Moon, one of these overlong, overblown, you know, overwrought, overdirected. So I'm over it. That's Transformers, Dark of the Moon. Number three, Answers to Nothing, which luckily is one of those films that came and went. It's one of those really annoying, insipid, insufferable dramas about a bunch of stories that intertwine, and Dane Cook was the star of that film. Number two, Your Highness. It's one of those sword and sorcery flick satires. It's really raunchy, and it's, you know, if you're amused by scatological humor, then that's the kind of movie that you would probably go for. But I think the worst film of the year, in my estimation, was The Change-Up. And this is one of those body-switching fantasies. But in this case, it was Ryan Reynolds and Jason Bateman who have this identity swap, and they mystically inhabit one another's bodies. And the only change-up to the formula is the amount of raunchiness that we're forced to endure. And I was just totally hating every moment I sat and watched this, and I felt, man, this is a cast that has been wasted. Okay, let's talk about, to close out here, a few of the films that we didn't get a chance to talk about earlier. One was Young Goethe in Love.
Yeah, I wanted to put in a plus for this. Young Goethe in Love, as in Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the great German poet, philosopher, playwright, who many people rank along Dante and Shakespeare. Oddly enough, we don't know that much about Goethe, but we do know something about his most popular novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther. That's what this movie, Young Goethe in Love, is about. How this young poet, who's having problems about deciding what to do with his life, has an ill-starred love affair, which leads to his writing of this novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther. It came out around 1774 and was a phenomenon. It's hard to even compare its popularity to anything that's been happening in our own time, and it vaulted Goethe into the front rank of the young writers of the day. Now, the more you know about Goethe's history, and I've looked into this quite a lot, you see how the Germans, just as much as the Americans, have no qualms for fabricating the storyline of a real-life character. But for all of that, it's beautifully shot, the locations are superb, and I just think it's a wonderful chance to delve into the world of the world's most famous playwright at that time. Even if you don't know much about it, it's at the Tivoli. I urge you to see it while it's still here, and thanks to Jerry for bringing it.
And your rating?
Oh, I'm giving it a 4.
And Maria, a sentence or two quickly about The Darkest Hour.
Darkest Hour, wouldn't you think we had a science fiction film that opened up on Christmas Day? It's one step above the average because we have a group of young college students in Moscow when the alien invasion comes. And for a change, people are not turned into zombies. They're turned into ash. And so they figured out a way to take care of them when nobody else can. And, oh, I'm going to give it about a 2.5.
And once they're ash, that's it, I assume.
That's it.
No coming back from that.
No coming back.
And one other title we'll quickly cover, Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, rated PG-13. This is director Guy Ritchie's sequel to his popular hit of a couple of years ago, Robert Downey Jr. as Sherlock Holmes, Jude Law as Watson. And Ritchie has turned Sherlock Holmes into a character that's more like 007 than Sherlock Holmes.
Except action, he needs a shave.
Yes, action-packed. Marie, how many stars would you give Sherlock Holmes?
1.5.
Okay, I'll give it a 3, so we'll count that as a 2.5 for Sherlock Holmes. To find our archives and subscribe to the Walt Bodine Show podcast, visit kcur.org. Our show was produced by Andrea Salenzi. Our announcer is Suzanne Hogan. And thanks to my fellow film critics today, I'm Russ Simmons, and this is the Walt Bodine Show. Enjoy your day.